Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and our next guests are two gentlemen who have taught at NYU's art department, Jonathan Berger and Michael Stipe. Michael Stipe was also in a band you may have heard of, REM. The group formed in Athens, Georgia, where Stipe was a studio art major at the University of Georgia studying photography and painting. Of course, REM were alt-rock pioneers. And as part of the band's aesthetic were the visuals that Stipe created for their album artwork and music videos. After 15 studio albums, REM dissolved in 2011, but Michael Stipe continued making art. In 2014, he was a resident artist and teacher in NYU's art department. In 2018, he released what he called a visual record, which consisted of photographs he'd taken over the last four decades. And on both of these projects, Stipe worked with his longtime collaborator, Jonathan Berger, an artist and associate professor in the Department of Art and Art Professions at NYU, whose work has been presented in galleries around the world. Berger's current project is An Introduction to Nameless Love, a collaborative exhibition that uses text-based sculptures to tell stories about uncommon kinds of connection. Michael Stipe contributed original verses to one of the pieces about the designers and spouses Charles and Ray Ames. The exhibition is on display now through April 5th at Participant Inc. on the Lower East Side. And Michael's also writing songs again. In addition to recording an original song for this specific project, he also released his first solo single last December, another one last month. Both gentlemen are in studio with me now. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks so much.
How did you two start collaborating?
We met through my best friend, Tom Gilroy, who was at McDowell.
McDowell, yeah, 2003.
And he said, it's incredibly boring, but there's one person who's amazing. Oh. And you have to meet him. And that one person, of course, was Jonathan Berger.
Did it prove to be true?
Yeah. In fact, we forged a lifelong friendship and possible collaboration.
Oh, yeah.
What did you find interesting about Michael's work and the way he works?
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, I grew up super aware of REM in the '90s and was a fan and also really looked up to Michael as someone who was really like a, in terms of as a young person in that moment, a super idiosyncratic, unique and rogue figure in the sort of pop landscape. And even though I grew up in New York City and grew up pretty close to kind of different kinds of underground culture, I understood him as the kind of person that I felt connected to in a more underground or kind of intuitive experimental way, as somebody like that who was operating in a pop arena. And so I saw that very clearly. And then sort of fast forwarding to the NYU project, I think one of the things that was happening right before that is that you'd started your Tumblr.
Right.
And I already knew Michael through Tom, but I was sort of following the Tumblr and looking at it. And one of the things that was amazing about it and sort of like made everything kind of, I don't know, come into focus very quickly is that the way that he was sort of posting and putting together images and ideas really, my experience with it really made clear to me the way his brain worked and that...
Which is wrong.
Huh?
Which is wrong. And my brain doesn't work completely.
Fabulously wrong. Radically, fabulously, and profoundly in the best way wrong. But it sort of let me know how like all these things when I was younger that I was looking up to was the sort of putting together of disparate parts that other people wouldn't put together and that made him unique and that also just were, you know, really rogue moves and what made him an artist ultimately. So the project that came, that we did at NYU, largely for me, was inspired by the kind of visual conversations he was having on his Tumblr at that time. Yeah,
we did a show that was comprised completely of light. Mm-hmm. And the students and myself and Jonathan worked with artists and interesting cultural figures who we invited in to guest over the course of the time that I was there teaching, and created an ongoing a gallery that was streaming kind of live. It was a little bit of a mm-hmm. radical idea at the time.
There was a shared class Tumblr, and the show changed every day, and students and the guest artists made the show completely different every day for 8 weeks.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So it was this ongoing thing, and we had this bank of images, and the images were generated in response to different conversations that we had, and then we would all take turns pulling from this massive image bank, and there were 15 live projectors that filled this like 3,500 square foot space. And so it was sort of like this way of curating images off of this image bank that came out of dialogue and making a dialogue that extended into the space and time of the show. That's what the show was about. And it was also largely about like intergenerational dialogue and how analog and digital interfaced. Mm-hmm.
You have a really good voice for radio. I
probably won't be able to listen to my voice later, but I appreciate that very much.
My guests are Jonathan Berger and Michael Stipe. Michael, what did you like about teaching?
I liked what Jonathan just mentioned. At one point, we brought in the artist Peaches as a guest to present ideas for the students to riff on for a week, and I was sat down with Jonathan in the classroom with the students, median age 18, and I said, our guest artist this week, I'm proud to announce, is Peaches. And I saw blank faces across the room. Yeah. And I was like, who knows who Peaches is by a show of hand? No one. So my job was to connect Peaches to someone who they would be. And I think my example was Lil' Kim. They all knew Lil' Kim. But I was able to connect Peaches to Lil' Kim and say Lil' Kim could not exist had Peaches not existed 15 years ago, 18 years ago, and here she is now with us, and these are her suggestions. So being able to make, I don't hang out with 18-year-olds a lot, 19-year-olds a lot. Having my own point of references kind of thrown in my face like that and having to act in the moment is not something I was used to, and so it really kind of sharpened my dull brain a little.
And I think it also, the other thing that was amazing about that in that regard is like, most of them didn't know who you were.
Exactly, which was refreshing, I have to say.
But it was also incredible, and then they did after. But I think the thing that was so special about that is like, they really respected you and they understood you as an artist and a contributor in a way that was completely direct and sincere in terms of your interaction with each other.
That wasn't related to any sort of REM fan.
It just was like, we're people in a room making stuff and having a dialogue. And I think when they realized the thing that got interesting after that was they were able to understand Michael as somebody who generated popular culture and as a consumer of popular culture. And the show is largely about popular culture. Yeah. And so it sort of went to this next level where they understood his relationship to the material in a different way. And I'm talking for you now, but that's hopefully okay. It's okay. But one of the reasons that I wanted him to teach this class and do the show is because he, you know, really deeply and sincerely is interested in and appreciates the ideas that young people have as people making popular culture now. So that, I think once we got into it, the thing that made it so unique was like those two very different but both valuable perspectives on, you know, the world of visual culture and images and how analogs turned into digital and stuff like that.
The current exhibition is An Introduction to Nameless Love. What is Nameless Love?
Nameless Love is actually, I read that term in a very slim book called Gay Sunshine Interview, which Allen Ginsberg did with Alan Young in the early 70s. And he's talking about his relationship with straight men. With Kerouac and Cassidy, and the complication and the sort of multidimensional nature of those relationships, and brings up nameless love as this thing that everybody is, that sort of like in a way insisting that love needs to stay in a space where we are okay with not understanding it and continuing to try to understand what it is and how it fits into our life. So he just sort of like, you know, kind of like takes the classification away as a position. And so the show is really about like forms of love that are life-changing and appear in these specifically six stories that I'm telling, or six sections of the show, in a way that's like non-romantic, but functions at the level of true love. And sort of just talking about how romance is sort of like dominating a hierarchy. And in fact, there's many kinds of relationships that change people's lives profoundly.
I'm going to try to describe it to people, these big sculptures with large metal texts, and they're in different shapes, and some are told like dialogues, others are more like narratives. There's one I'm going to read. It starts, I met Marky Doodles at a gathering of ventriloquist dummies that I hosted in Los Angeles in March 2018. We sat We all sat around in a circle and talked. I asked the dummies, four of them, a number of questions about love, relationships, partnering, friends, imaginary and otherwise, fears, everyday preoccupations, and the current political climate. And the final question you ask is, where do you see yourself in 5 years from now? And then it says, Marky Doodles, the youngest of the group, did not hesitate to answer, I'd really like to be a person by then.
And that is an excerpt
incredible.
From an incredible book by Mady Schutzman, actually. And Mady is someone I've known for 22 years, and I invited her to write a book at the same time I was making my exhibit, and we corresponded for 2 years about this bigger idea, and I was making my show, and she was writing this book. And her book is a lot about multiple selves. So it's like ventriloquist dummies, mm-hmm. doppelgangers, ghosts, and multiple personalities, and five excerpts from that book are in the show. So that's one section. And she held this amazing round table with all these ventriloquist dummies about love, and the dummies all talked. So that's where that comes from.
Incredible. Well. I just walked actually from participant to get here for the interview. I have to say it's a really, I recommend going on your lunch break. There were two other people in the gallery.
Ooh, how did they react to it? When you were watching,
well, it was my best friend Tom who introduced us, okay. And our friend Ivy.
Okay,
but we planned to meet there, but seeing it with not a lot of people around, it's just so immersive and such an incredible presentation, and it's heartbreaking and at the same time very, very funny and very full of life and beauty. I strongly recommend everyone who hears this go and see it.
Can you describe the materials for people a little bit? Because I think that really adds something special to it.
Yeah, it's comprised of over 533,000 tin, nickel, and charcoal parts. It's the sort of simple answer. But the sculptures take the form of these sort of like oversized see-through illuminated manuscripts. Mm-hmm. So they're 33,000 inch and a quarter high tin letters that were hand-hammered and hand-soldered to these sort of like scaffolding backings. And so they're all see-through. So you walk into the show and there's the sort of thing that you're constantly navigating is there's like an abstract thing where all these letters are sort of coming together, and then you'll find yourself in front of one piece that you're able to read. But in order to read, because of the way that light bounces off of these silver letters, you kind of physically have to move in order to read. So there's a real physical relationship to the
Yeah, you kind of become a part of the show, I think. You have to move around it to see it, to actually read it like text. But you feel like you're living inside a giant, shiny silver book, mm-hmm. or manuscript. It's shockingly beautiful. And then Jonathan, tell her about the floor. Because this is
it's all charcoal. Yeah. These little charcoal squares.
Yeah, the floor is sort of like a charcoal. It almost feels like charcoal tile. And I think for me, that was actually just, you know, people are like, what does it mean? And I think it actually, I have a history with exhibition design. And I think that decision was in a way more like formal, because I wanted the floor to reflect the amount of labor and reverence that labor had for all these subjects. Like, we made the show as elaborately as we did because I wanted to make a show that really was, you know, in a way devotional towards the importance of these stories, and the floor reflects that. But it also, like, the charcoal comes off on your shoes, and it has a material quality that it has the labor in it, but it also, I think, materially has a certain kind of weight and impact, visceral impact. I mean, you're better in a way because I'm so in it, but I think it also, it's distinctly not contemporary. Like, it feels to me, I wanted to make something that maybe more felt like a cathedral or like
Pompeii or a Greek island 2,000 years ago, like what you would be walking on if they were you know fixing up the giant holy place again. So it feels like a holy place, and it feels like a mystery. The floor to me, the whole thing feels very, it's totally immersive, but it's very mysterious, and it's beautifully lit. Like, mm-hmm. it's really something, you kind of have to experience it. You can see pictures, there's a lot of them on Instagram right now, but you can see pictures of it, but you really kind of have to go and be a part of it.
My guests are Jonathan Berger and Micah Stipe. We're talking about Introduction to Nameless Love, which is currently at Participation, Inc. So the part of the exhibition you worked on, Michael, is about the Ames.
Yeah.
Ray and Charles Ames.
Yeah.
Love their chairs. What about that story interested you?
Jonathan pointed me in the direction of Ray particularly, and she was the one half of that collaborative. They were married They were very much in love, but their love became something very different, I think, over the course of their mm-hmm. lives. And through Jonathan's eyes, my participation, through Jonathan's eyes, I saw their true love as their work, and reading about them, and Jonathan gave me mountains and mountains of books and things to look at in order to write the piece. So I wrote this lyric for a little pop song, and it's very, very simple, but it describes it's working on a bunch of levels. I hope. In terms of the lyric, I'm writing from race perspective, so I'm not a woman, one. I'm not a woman who was doing her work in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, too, and I was not married to Charles, but I tried to get inside her a little bit, and the first line of the song is I love a challenge, and the second line is I love a man, and that kind of tells the story. That's a very important, I think, aspect. I don't think Charles was an easy person to be in love with, and I don't think that their love was particularly easy, but their love of their work together and what they created was, I think they both recognized it as something eternal.
Let's take a listen to a little bit of it.
I love a challenge. I love a man. I love his mind. I love the corners of his mouth when we find. This life is good, this life is grand, this life is fine. He knows me real, real, real. We are a kind. My name is Ray, Ray, Ray. It's a man's name. My name is Ray, Ray, Ray. I play a man's game.
That is a tremendously sweet song.
Thank you. It breaks. It's metronomic, which I love. And it breaks at the end of the song. It breaks when she's announcing this is our time. It breaks the metronome. It steps out of its meter when she emphasizes this is our time. This is our time. This is our time. And that little break, I think, indicates something about the potency of the work that they did and her recognizing that it was bigger than both of them and that combined what they created was bigger than what either of them could ever do singularly.
What is
Nameless Love. There it is.
What is that song? What did it do for you when you heard it?
It made me cry. that was the first thing. I was like, that's why you go to the visionary professionals, because they land. They land it.
Because it's not a hobby. They're good at it.
Yeah, I think it really did nail it. You know, I mean, I think they. What Michael said is true. I think that, like, the one further thing I would. There's a couple things that are really remarkable. They died 10 years apart to the day. And her friends who were close with her at that time say she was waiting to die to do it exactly 10 years apart. Wow. And they, you know, it's no secret that their marriage was extremely troubled and sort of fell apart romantically, but they couldn't not work together. They just, I mean, it's what Michael said. And I think the song really embodies that and has a tenderness, but I think also has the complication in it, you know? And I think the danger with any storytelling like this is that it's very easy to sort of sanitize stuff or sort of turn it into something that's just, you know, just beautiful. And I think the song does a really amazing job of doing both.
I thought about, you know, I want to say Johnny Cash wrote A Boy Named Sue. Is that?
I think so.
Being a woman named Ray in that time period must have been a little difficult.
This is an ongoing project. People can see it in New York until April 5th. Does it have a next home?
It does have a next home. I can't say what it is. It's not in America. And I hope that it, there's other chapters that aren't done. I mean, I'll just tell you a couple. There's a story about Roy and Silo, who were the gay penguins in the Central Park Zoo, who found a rock and insisted that it was an egg and sat on it to term, believing that it was going to hatch. So that section is about, like, the relationship.
Didn't expect to hear that this morning.
Welcome to the mind of Jonathan Berger.
And so that section, just to give an extreme other example, is about the relationship between animals and inanimate objects. So I'm really trying to sort of expand it as far as it can go. And for that, I spoke with the former director of the Central Park Zoo and their handler, which was amazing. And you talked about that whole period of time.
More music from you, Michael? Will we have some more?
Yes. I'm writing. Yes. I'm working in music again, and I'm loving it. I've released those two singles that you mentioned, and I'm happy that the proceeds are, for the first year, all of my proceeds are going to organizations that I really respect and admire, environmental organizations. So I'm having fun with it. I'm not thinking about a career. I don't have to anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm not thinking about the pressures of working within an industry. I'm just doing things that I love. And as it turns out, music is an easy medium for me to work with. So I'm enjoying it.
That's a nice life. The name of the piece is Introduction to Nameless Love. It is at Participant Inc. on the Lower East Side through April 5th. Michael Stipe and Jonathan Berger, thank you for coming to the studio.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
This is All of It.